Back to you, Roy. I definitely is in mobile installation about it. I got a good analyzer, brand new. I got a brand new analyzer, the Comet. My antenna is brand new too. It's a Hodler antenna. The WR is low, 1.1, 1.2. I try in different coils, 40 meters and 20 meters, and they work in the same. The 20 meters, he worked with the 1.1 without antenna tuner. And the 40 meters also too without antenna tuner. But the SWO is fine. No problem at all. But I want to check again anyway. Somebody told me, I think so with Eddie, the AM radio guy. He told me, different search with the car. Put another battery at the side and try it that way. But the problem is, if I put the battery at the side, I have to get the charger because I need to charge the battery anyway. But I don't know about that way. So what do you think about it?
Well, for the time
you tried a dummy load in place of your antenna, a 50-ohm resistive load specifically meant for the purpose of being, a dummy antenna. Thermaline would be a good choice. Heathkit made a wonderful product for years, and I think MFJ has the follow-on to the Heathkit product. For a modest cost, these things are out there. Certainly buy one at a ham fest. But does it do the same thing you transmit into a dummy load as opposed to your antenna? And that may be something you'd want to check. Back to you.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Maybe I want to try that with that is anyway. Thank you very much. And go ahead, I try to do this my best, and you try to do the best. Thank you, I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you very much. And there was a 2FIH, I didn't get the prefix. You had a question out there?
Yes, KB2FYH, my name is Jim. Do you copy?
I do indeed, Jim.
Okay, I won't keep you long. Going back to the previous subject of solar storms, I recall reading about the 1859 solar storm, great magnitude, that the sky lit up. Now, if that is so, what would happen today if the sky lit up like that, the satellites in the air, airplanes flying, cars driving with computers, hospital equipment, power, grids, everything that's in your house? I could only imagine it would send us back to the Stone Age. Over.
Well, not surprisingly, I think they either did a movie or a television show with that concept. What they used rather than a natural disaster, I think, was one of those fusion bombs just set off to make the mother of all pulse weapons. So the idea is a massive electromagnetic wave, nice, dirty, but very loud one, would basically fuse all of the high-end, high-gain field effects transistors. All the electronics would kind of go dead on us, and we were kind of stuck back at the, not exactly the Stone Age, because, the 1800s really had no electricity to speak of, but back to the 1800s and all the computer records and financial functions, and it wreaked havoc. So it sort of depends upon how bad it is and what's been hardened against it. Military has, I'm sure, specs for hardened front ends of radios so that EMPs are less likely to completely destroy their function. But we poor civilians probably don't have anything like that. So, yeah, you could write a really bad fiction story about a massive equivalent to an electromagnetic pulse weapon that just kind of knocks out the last 150 years of technology.
Thanks very much for that comment. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Jim. I mean, hopefully it'll never happen. It's one of those things. You know, in addition to things like the electromagnetic pulse weapons and discharges from the sun, there are solar happenstances in our galaxy that emit massive quantities of gamma outburst effects. And unfortunately, if you happen to be real unlucky and you're right in line to that sun, that star's gamma emission, it could basically fry a planet in a fraction of a second. You know, the ultimate really, really bad luck day.
Okay, thanks for everything.
You're welcome, Jim. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the LiveMark Technical Net. Still have a little bit more time. If anyone has any topics for discussion or questions or comments, feel free to hit that push to talk.
K2SCP, that book, Roy, is The Day After.
Okay, very good, Chris. Thank you. Was it made into a movie or a television series?
I believe they did make a movie in it, but I'm not familiar with that. I did have the book.
No, okay. You know, I mean, it certainly is a good premise for a real scary story. So I don't think I ever got around to see the movie, obviously, because I have no memory of it. I just remember the synopsis, which, you know, is scary as heck. You know, we rely so heavily on electronics today. You know, if something like this would have happened, say, in the 1950s, it would be a massive inconvenience. But I don't think it would quite traumatize people as much as it would now. You know, you get a Zoomer and you remove their internet access, and I don't know. I don't know how they're going to survive that.
One of the interesting things in the scenario in the book, and it's very true to life if it were to occur, is the fact that transportation comes to a halt because all the computers and all the cars would get zapped. And none of the new cars would work except for anyone who had a classic car, one of those old, prior to probably the 60s or something, continue to work, but everything else is dead. And, yeah, it's a very scary book. And from what I understand, Congress has been talking about those scenarios behind the scenes.
Well, you know, I mean, they get paid to talk about disasters and occasionally to make disasters of their own. Yeah, I mean, that's not a surprisingly the most novel concept. I remember the old Battlestar Galactica television show, which was a very strange show, and they remade it, and it kind of broke one of the major rules that I hold to, that remakes are always worse than the originals. But when Ronald Moore made the remake of Battlestar Galactica, it was much, much better. But the premise was that they were fighting a bunch of robots out to kill them, and they couldn't trust computerized systems because the robots would just get into the system. So they had to fall back to museum pieces of equipment. That was the only thing they could properly fight the robots with. And so it was kind of another version of that, where you go to the technology museum and you pull out the mothball, the demothball the Model Ts, and you use all the stuff that was made before computer chips were around. Oh, well, I guess no one appreciated Battlestar Galactica. The star was the guy who did Ben Cartwright from Bonanza. I still remember that. That was a very strange television show. Anyway, anyone with any questions, answers, comments, or what have you before we call this episode an end? Okay, I guess everyone's tired tonight. It is 10:12, so we're giving you 3 extra minutes, Paul. So let me thank everyone who participated tonight. Again, I don't know if you like the slightly different orientation, although probably if I didn't have those stories, I would be saying this about 40 minutes earlier. Nevertheless, you know, if you liked it, if you didn't like it, you can always email me and tell me. I'll read them. I may not respond. I may not follow your advice, but I will read them. So, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Please come back next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. And now we got Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, very good, Roy. And it's WS2N. And one other email that we had gotten from the ARRL talked about staying away from 7.88 kilohertz, you know, on 40 meters. They're apparently using that for some of the work in Hawaii, although I think they've really given up with their with rescue. I think they're really into recovery at this point. But that's a shame what went on there. Actually, a lot of items. You know, there were eight rocket launches. I'm not going to cover them all, but in just 1 week from different places around the world. So, I mean, you know, that it's coming to the point where it's averaging one a day, you know, 365 launches a year. It's not going to be that many, but they're getting there. Let me drop it. This WS2N. About that frequency, you know, I've been on 40 meters a lot, and I've never worked Hawaii, so I don't think we'd have a problem from New York, but I guess if you're out west, that could be an issue. My guess is, you know, if you're California, you could probably work Hawaii all the time. Yeah, there was a Russian spacewalk the other day. And the Russians went outside. You know, there's 3 of them on board the International Space Station. And 2 of them went out to, two of them. And they went out to do a spacewalk to bring these debris shields from one module to another module. Recently, they put a module up a year or so ago called the Nakia module. And they want to put this thing in full operation, and there's 3 debris shields located on another module, and they had to bring it to another one. But they're still at it, you know, with all the problems going on with the Ukraine. They're still doing that work, and they actually transmitted the spacewalk on NASA TV. There you go. I got a lot of little stories. Well, another one with the Russians. Russians launched a spacecraft to the moon, and they launched from Vostochny, Russia. Most of the spaceports are located in and around near Moscow, you know, either north or south of Moscow. This one is launched is 3,000 miles away from Moscow, you know, east of it, actually very getting close to Alaska, and they set up a small city there. Maybe about 20 years ago, they started working on it, and they started launching maybe 2014. So they launched the Soyuz 2-1 rocket from that launch complex. On board is a lander called Lunar 25. They launched a lot of missions back in the day when they were the Soviet Union. And the last one they launched to the moon was called Lunar 24. And that thing was 1976. So it's been a long time, and you know, for them doing something like this. Well, Lunar 25 is on its way, and last time I looked, it's about 8 or 9 days before it will do a lunar landing, and they're going to aim for the South Pole. Everybody's going for the South Pole. The Artemis program, China wants to do it, and now the Russians. And as well as India. India has one that's on the way to the moon right now, and that's supposed to land on the 23rd, so it's going to be right around that time for both of these spacecraft to try to land. You know, it's a good-sized lander. This thing stands about 10 feet tall. It does have a robotic arm on board to grab some soil and do some testing. It's not a sample return mission, although they have that planned in the future. It's amazing how Russia is still at it. This WS-1. All right, back to America. Well, anyway, New Mexico, where the company Virgin Galactic launched their space plane. You know, I mean, it's almost American. I mean, it's owned by Richard Branson. He comes out of England. He's one of the main owners. It's also partly owned, a good portion of it, by Saudi Arabia and some other investors. But they got this thing off the ground. They have a carrier plane, 4 jet engine vehicle, this dual fuselage airplane that carries the space plane to around 45,000 feet. The space plane is called Unity. The carrier plane is called Eve. Anyway, it got up to elevation roughly 9 miles up above the surface, and it dropped it. And with that, 6 more people wound up getting into suborbital space. They had on board a pilot. They had a commander. So they had 2 people flying this thing. And then a third employee, last name is Moses. She's been up, I think, 3 or 4 different times so far. She's back with the passengers. And then they have 3 paying passengers. One guy, he's like 80 years old. He paid $250,000 like 15 years ago when they first came up with this idea. I guess he's glad he did at the time, because now it's up to $450,000 if you were to buy a ticket today. And then the other 2 people were, I think they said they were from one of the islands, Antigua. And there was it's a mother and daughter, and they apparently won some kind of contest. So I guess that's the way it is nowadays. To get the space, you gotta win a contest. And anyway, they put them on board. This is after, I don't know, a week of training down in New Mexico. They put them on this space plane with no spacesuit whatsoever. And then the thing goes up to, what is it, around 55 miles high, enough to qualify. And then they get about 4 minutes of no gravity. You know, they fly around in the inside. They disconnect their seatbelt, float around, and then return, put their seatbelt back on after about 4 minutes. And they return. But, you know, this contraption, it folds in half. It's a strange-looking vehicle. If you've ever seen this bizarre design that Unity is. But I successfully made it back. And they think they're going to be doing this, averaging once a month. They're going to be bringing people up. Which, I mean, it sounds like a lot. I don't know if they could keep up with that manifest. But with all the launches that we've had this year, you know, we've had people go up from China, we've had people go from the United States to the International Space Station. They're already up to 29 people have already flown in space this year. So, yeah, as time goes on, it's amazing, you know. Start off with Alan Shepard, suborbital flight, back in the early 1960s, and you work your way up to, you know, three or six per year, you know, with Apollo. And time goes on, and we're already up to 29, and we still got another, what, 5 months or so before the end of the year. Let me drop it for any comments. This is WS2N. Leaving a space for Echo. Echo Link. Didn't hear Frank or anybody. Another successful flight. This time, it was on Mars. The Ingenuity helicopter flew again. This time, it was its 54th flight. You know, it's had some problems here and there, and they correct it. Most of the times, it's software related, and this one had a problem on 53. Well, 54 was successful, but 53. We're supposed to fly for 2.5 minutes, travel 1,000 feet, but it didn't. It went up for 25 seconds, came back down right away. It's pre-programmed to, you know, if it sees a problem, it just powers down and lands. And that's what happened, and they had to spend some time trying to figure out what the problem was. And they believe it has to do with the camera system. They take a lot of pictures, like, I don't know, 30 pictures a second. And they use these pictures to figure out where they're going to land as they go along. And if a couple of the pictures get corrupted or some problem like that, this is what would happen. It's, you know, designed into the system. So they figured it out, and I guess they sent a fix up to either a software patch or maybe a different flight plan. And anyway, on flight 54, it was successful. This thing was only supposed to fly tops five flights, and they were going to shut it down. But it was so successful after five flights that they decided to keep this going. It flies ahead of Perseverance, the rover that brought Ingenuity to Mars. So a very successful program. So successful that when they do a sample return, if they could ever afford it, I know that NASA's starting to have money problems. I heard it's still being developed. They plan on eventually sending a spacecraft to land on Mars in the same place where Perseverance landed. And at that point, they plan on collecting all these test tubes, titanium type test tubes that the rover has been putting soil samples, core bore samples into. Eventually these samples will be collected and put into a sample return rocket, a solid fuel rocket, actually two stages. So they plan on landing this two-stage rocket on Mars years from now, and then because the helicopter program, Ingenuity, has been so successful, they're going to send two more with that flight. They're going to be more advanced, a little bit bigger, more science capability on it. But one of the things it's going to have is a little grabber. So in Chase, for some reason, Perseverance isn't able to pick up all these test tubes that it's leaving all over the place and bring them back to wherever this thing lands. The helicopters, two helicopters, will go off and fly a mission to pick them up one at a time and bring it back to the sample return rocket. So they got big plans. It's going to cost billions of dollars, but I mean, it's all been figured in. Although they are looking to cut some funds with NASA, and if they do that, that could probably hurt the Mars sample return program, which would be a nightmare for all the scientists that would love to get their hands on this stuff. Any comments? Put in that. Before I continue on, let me drop it. Okay, I brought this other topic up last week about Star Lab. Not Skylab, but Star Lab. That's now going to be built by a company called Voyager, which is an American company. And they've teamed up with Airbus, which is headquartered out of the Netherlands. That's the company that makes these jets, you know, like the 380 wide, multi-billion dollar company. And they've teamed up together to try to build the Starlab space station. The goal is to have something replace the International Space Station some years from now. And they actually have plans of launching this thing right now in 2028. It's roughly about 25 feet long and about 24 feet in diameter. Would have three different level would actually spin, creating a gravity, maybe as much as what you would get on Mars, but it would be something. It would be a good place for astronauts to sleep. You could, you know, sit up, put your bag up against the wall. I think it would be appreciated. Although some people I probably want to sleep in zero G, you'd have that that option, because it would only be the bottom level that would be turning, and then the upper two levels would not be turning. I would like to see how this is all going to be done. There's no details on that whatsoever, but there's money involved. NASA already had funded $140 million a year or two ago to start working on this through Voyager, and that's the American company. They're going to own over 50% of this operation, but the other 49% of it is going to be owned by Airbus, or maybe some other people involved, maybe a couple of other investors. But I mean, their idea is not to set this thing up as a floating hotel, although they're getting Hilton involved with the design of the interior. Its main is going to be to continue on what the ISS has been doing for years. Since 2001, it's been occupied doing science. So Starlab will be, you know, nothing but an extension of the ISS when that thing is gone. Right now, the prediction date is probably 2030. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's a little early. They're going to probably figure a little. Well, any comments? Heard is a question I got years ago, but somebody else had brought it up recently, and they talked about the numbering system for all these STS
missions that have gone up, the space transportation missions, all the shuttle missions that flew. You know, there were a total of 135 missions that took astronauts to orbit and eventually to the International Space Station, instrumental in building that space station and for supplying it with equipment, food, and people. But the numbering system was kind of strange after the ninth flight of the shuttles. There was a guy that got involved with this. He was the NASA administrator at the time, James Biggs. And he was superstitious. He did not like the number 13. So, you know, what is that, triskaidekaphobia, or one of them words with about 20 letters in it. Anyway, he hated the number 13. And he was always worried about a duplication of Apollo 13, which, of course, was the one that didn't make it to the moon. It made it back to Earth, but barely. So he decided to start changing the numbers. And he came up with a system where he would, let's say, name the system 41B, you know, a flight 41B. Instead of a progressive number, you know. Now, how could 41B come after, you know, number 9 or number 10 of the actual flight? So STS-41B would be, for example, 4 would represent the year, the last number of the year. So in this case, it was 1984. But then they went by fiscal years, and in the United States, fiscal year it starts September 1st and it starts October 1st and ends the next year, September 31st. So that's what they went by. The 4 represented the last number of the year. So if it was going up in 1985, it, you know, the number would start with a 5. So in this case, 41B, you know, it would have gone up in 1984, planned to go up in 1984. Number 1 stood for the launch facility that they were using. 1 would be Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral area down in Florida. If it was a number 2, that means they were going to plan on launching out of Vandenberg, out of California, which was a thing. They came very close to actually launching shuttles out of California. But due to the Challenger accident, they canceled that idea. The next flight after Challenger was supposed to be a military mission flown out of California. Well, that would have had a number of 2. But after that disaster, they said, that's it. We're not going to use California. We're just going to launch out of Florida. We've got enough problems. They were thinking they were going to have like 50 flights a year. Well, that never materialized. The turnaround time was enormous on getting a space shuttle ready for another flight. And then the letter B would stand for, let's say, that would be like the second, because it's the second letter, that would be the second flight of that year. So it would be, 41B would be 1984 from Florida, this is the 1, and then the B would mean the second flight of that year. That's how they got involved with that. And as time went on, eventually you had Challenger, and that was named like that as well. I think that was 51G, I think it was. So by the way, you know, they'd keep that number even if the year went to a different year. They would keep that designation, whatever they were originally called. But after the Challenger disaster, they said, that's it. We're going back to regular numbering system. This is way too confusing. And then the next flight after that, which I think was Discovery, sure enough, they call that 26, STS 26, 27, and so forth, all the way up to 135. Out of all of them, they all made it to orbit except for STS 107. Unfortunately, that was Columbia that did not make it back to Earth. Made it to orbit, you know, the crew did fine. It was not an international space station flight, but when they came back, the tiles were missing due to what happened launching off the pad. A bunch of foam the size of a suitcase hit the carbon on a wing, plus some tiles, and eventually that thing overheated. Unfortunately, they lost the crew on Columbia. That was STS-107. Anyway, this is some of the history of the space shuttle system. Anybody have any questions or comments? This is WS2M.
If I didn't know better, I'd say the numbering system was a diabolical plot to confuse the Russians during the Cold War. WB2BXL.
Well, it was confused me, and it wasn't really known. I mean, it wasn't publicized, and we didn't have the internet back then, so it wasn't easy to figure out why they were calling these things different numbers. Once in a while, you would hear somebody trying to explain it, and everybody's eyes would glaze over, and they would go on to something else. But interesting. Weird things that they did, and it was based all on this one guy, Biggs. He just didn't like number 13, you know. I don't know if it's true. I heard that in England, the number 13 is a lucky number, but I don't know if anybody ever heard that's true. Another number. I never got the idea that you got into the city years ago and you go from floor to floor and it wouldn't be a floor 13. That was very strange. There's three communication satellites that were launched by NASA. And they used the Electron rocket to put these things into space, launched out of New Zealand by Rocket Lab. And the name of the satellites are called Starlink. You know, Starlink, not Starlink, but Starlink satellites by NASA. And these things communicate with one another. So they're going to stay relatively close to one another, no more than like 40 miles apart from one another as they go around in orbit. And the idea is to test its autonomous ability to communicate with one another. They're going to vote between each other which one should do a certain job. And by the way, one of the jobs that these Starlink satellites are going to be looking at is the ionosphere, which as a ham radio operator, I'm always interested in. But this is designed really to see how it does, and they'll try to improve on it. They plan on eventually sending these types of satellites to other worlds, Moon, Mars, and even beyond that. You know, if they can communicate with one another and do measurements. Sometimes they'll do a form of interferometry. They might do that. Who knows where that could go, but the smarts in these computers are so good that that's how far they're getting. And I don't think it has AI on it yet, but I'm going to be surprised if someday they're launching satellites with that capability as well. But anyway, they're doing very good, and it's good to see. There's other missions that are going to be done like that as well. They have three rovers that are going to go to the moon. Three planned rovers that NASA's trying to put together. Same type of thing. You're going to have the three of them will be riding around on the moon. They're going to launch at one time, and they'll be able to work together, talking to one another and making decisions on where to go, what to do. So autonomous is the way to go. The space missions. Any comments? A news conference last week. NASA had one on about the Starliner mission. The CFT Starliner is the one being built by Boeing. It's launched by a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. They plan on putting it on top of the Atlas V. In fact, they've already done that two times to launch to the International Space Station. Starliner is a human-rated spacecraft. They plan on eventually flying four people at a time to the International Space Station, similar to what SpaceX does out now with Dragon. Now, Boeing is way behind schedule. A couple of years ago, they should have had this thing up and running. Had some problems. Computer problems early on, like I said, first mission that was launched had those problems. What happened was it was supposed to go to the International Space Station, didn't have enough fuel because it had these computer problems. The spacecraft thought it was in a different location. It kept firing its thrusters to try to get to where it's supposed to be in space. It knows where it is in space. It has star trackers and all. And it saw it was in the wrong place. And it all had to do with timing on a computer. It was set wrong. So they ran short on fuel. Instead of a five-day dock mission to the space station, they never made it there. And they shortened it to a two-and-a-half-day mission, and they deorbited it. And it actually went back to where it's supposed to, into the White Sands, New Mexico, landed successfully. All that worked good. Parachutes, airbags, when they get down to the ground, big six airbags come out. All went well. They've done some study. Oh, by the way, after that, they did successfully launch another one on the Atlas V rocket, and that one did make it to the International Space Station. They actually had a crew members go inside of it. That were on the space station, poke around with it, and eventually it was again returned to White Sands, New Mexico, successfully. But then they came across these other problems. They call them the soft links on the parachute system. Everything worked good the two times that they came back from space. But they ran other tests. Suppose one of the parachutes don't open. There's three big parachutes that open up. Suppose designed to be safe to come back on two parachutes. When they ran those tests, they noticed some of the links weren't strong enough. They call them soft links. It connects the lines, from the parachute to the main cables on the spacecraft. So rather than have a possibility of one of these breaking in a real flight, they redesigned. And I think they said they're 80% done. There's a lot of these soft link things that have to be manufactured. They're making them out of Kevlar, and they're almost done with them. So they're going to be fine. They don't have to retest the parachute for that. And there was another problem with the tape. There's tape that they use. There's wiring all on the inside of the space station. Wiring harnesses, wires going everywhere. And on the panels and here and there. And they cover it with this tape after they're done, in case somebody bangs something, you don't fray a wire and cause a problem. What happens is the tape that they were using, they realized this now, you know, after years of accepting it, that under certain conditions, under certain oxygen levels, it's possible that this tape could ignite if there was a spark. So it's possible of a fire inside of a spacecraft. They decided to remove all the tape, and they were in the process of doing that. I think they said they have like 80% of that stuff removed, too. So there's some more they have to do. And they replace it with some other kind of tape that's got a better fire rating, better way of protecting the wires. So that's how it's going. They plan on eventually now launching to the space station with a crew. Well, they're going to have a test crew, two people. Whitmore and Sonny Williams are going to, Barry Whitmore and Sonny Williams are a crew. Eventually they'll have crews of four, but for the first test flight to the International Space Station, these two have been raring to go for, it seems like, years now. It looks like they'll get their chance in March. That's the plan now, March, and depending on crew rotations and, you know, things going up and down to the International Space Station, the cargo vehicles, you know, there's always a possibility of delay, but Boeing says we're going to be ready in March. If there's an opening to fly to the space station, we're going to do it. So that'd be great. It's a nice looking vehicle. Diameter is bigger, so you have more cubic feet inside. It looks like a nice vehicle to travel in. Although they say SpaceX is good, this one looks better. You know, I've seen the inside of the pictures when it was attached to the space station, and they had a couple of astronauts go inside. It looks a touch more roomier and very well designed. We'll see. That will probably not be launched on the Atlas V rocket as time goes on. Atlas V is being retired, and that's going to be probably put on the Vulcan rocket, the new Vulcan rocket that hasn't even flown yet. First mission of Vulcan is supposed to be the end of this year, and that's going to be a lunar mission, sending Astrobiotica lander to the moon. And then the next one after that is supposed to be Dream Chaser. And that's the one that looks like a small version of the STS shuttle system, capability of carrying up to 7 people on board. And after that, then they would be ready to fly Starliner. So maybe they'll keep an extra Atlas V available for this flight where they don't have to worry too much about pressing a date with Vulcan. You know, Vulcan's going to replace the Atlas V. It's also going to replace the Delta IV, which they've been flying for decades as well. Both very successful rockets, and Vulcan is supposed to replace them. Any comments? Thing I wanted to go over last week or the week before, we were talking about Voyager and its problem. You know, the antenna was 2 degrees off. Anyway, they've worked that problem out. We covered that last week, but we were talking about where eventually these things are going and how long it's going to take to get there. Well, I looked that up, and sure enough, Voyager 1 will take 40,000 years. I remember talking about this last week. 40,000 years to reach, I said it was Sirius. It wasn't Sirius. It's a star called AC plus 79, 3888. It's a star
that is destined to see Voyager 1 40,000 years from now. That'll be the first star Voyager 1 comes across. I conflated that with Cirrus. I was thinking 40,000 years to Cirrus. No, it's not 40,000 years to this other star, but to Cirrus, then that's Voyager 2. And get this, it's going to take 296,000 years. You know, I mean that. Let me drop it. That's. almost 300,000 years for this thing to get there. I mean, I think the galaxy turns. I think it's 250,000 years the galaxy makes one complete turn. That's how long it's going to be before Voyager 2 makes it to Cirrus. And I think Cirrus is only like 8 light years from us. So, you know, that's really outrageous. Anyway, any comments, for this topic or any of the other topics we covered tonight?
I could comment on a previous thing that was mentioned earlier in the net case.
Yeah, John, KC2, Seychelles, go ahead.
Yeah, Paul, first off, always love the SpaceNet. Don't take the lack of comments as nobody's listening. We love it. Sometimes my kids are listening as well. But earlier, and I've heard it many times in many places, we talk about space junk crashing in to other, or, you know, even just satellites, not even junk. We talk about space objects crashing into other space objects. And I always find this fascinating because I think about the, you know, how vast the surface of the Earth is. And when you go out to larger diameters, larger spheres, and not only a larger sphere, but a less... Well, you have more options of going up, down, left, and right instead of like the surface of the Earth with objects sitting on the Earth. On the surface, it's almost a two-dimensional problem. But in space, you have another dimension and you have larger spheres to travel in. How likely are these collisions that people talk about? How really likely is that to happen when you have such a vast area?
Yeah, well, it's very unlikely, but, you know, they keep sending these things up. SpaceX now has over 4,000 up there. They plan on doing 30,000 eventually. China plans on doing the same thing. OneWeb has a little over 600 up there for communications. They're doing a broadband system as well. One of the launches that went off last week, a Soyuz launch from Plesk, Russia, that had satellites on board. Pretty sure they were GPS type of satellites, but you know you have them up there. There's thousands and thousands of active satellites now, probably 10,000 total, I don't know. The number's getting out of hand. Plus, maybe another, 50,000 or more pieces that are bigger than 4 inches. And then they said there's a million things that could be smaller than that, maybe the size of a nut flying in orbit. So sooner or later, something hits something. There's pictures of a
speck of paint that hit the windshield of the space shuttle one time and put a ding in it, you know, like you would get in your car. And they figured out it was, you know, what it was from. It was from a flight from India that actually goes in the wrong direction. Instead of going, you know, launching to the east, launches to the west. They can't launch to the east because then they'd be over, you know, Palestine and, you know, over Jordan. They don't want to do that. So they're going to launch over the Mediterranean in case something comes, you know, if the rocket fails. So here's this thing going 25,000 miles an hour to the west, though. And space shuttle, correction, not 25, 17,500 miles to the west per hour. And then space shuttle going 17,500 miles to the east. And one little fleck of paint hit the windshield at over 30,000 miles per hour. So, you know, it seems unlikely. I mean, it's a vast area, especially when you get up the geosynchronous area. You know, what is that, 23,000 miles up? That's like three times the diameter of the Earth. You know, if you take that distance, measure it from here straight up, that's where the geosynchronous satellites are sitting. And there's many hundreds of those things sitting up there. But low Earth orbit is really a problem. They managed to keep things apart. One of the tests on the Starlink satellite system that I told you that NASA launched on Electron, the three satellites, one of the things that they have is exactly how far they are between one another. And if they get too close, they could move apart. You know, if you had this with all satellites, from, you know, some kind of a national agreement,
last time complete,
you might not have that much of a problem in the future. It has happened with two satellites. There was an Iridium satellite and a Russia satellite. A Russian satellite was no longer functioning, and they came in at like not a 90, but intersected in that kind of a direction, and they did hit. Well, I think that was probably 2000. I remember talking about this. Well, I guess 2007. Anyway, I could find out on the internet, but there was a hit, and they have to monitor all this. It's a monumental job to keep everybody apart. Back to you, John. What do you think?
Yeah, sorry, my note was IDing. Hold on, let me make sure I have it. Yeah, real interesting, Paul. Yeah, I mean, it's vast, right? I mean, probably, somebody calculated all this stuff, it could fit into some, you know, really large warehouse somewhere, you know, maybe even the campus of the new TSCM factory in Phoenix, but it's not a lot of stuff, it's not very large, but I guess when it does happen, the real answer is that the speed and the physics are the real issue, right? So it might be highly unlikely, but when it does happen, the results are probably quite dramatic, is one of the answers here. So making sure it never happens is going to be a more difficult task as we move forward into the future. But yeah, I mean, if a fleck of paint can do that, I've seen the videos where they, like, simulate some, like, small speck of something smashing into something at some really high speed, and the amount of damage it can do is quite impressive. So I can imagine the cost and the damage of something like that. Anyway, real interesting. I appreciate the comments, and I will think more about it, read more about it, and I'm going to look up that Iridium satellite incident. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, if I had time, I could search my documents, you know. I use Google Docs. I could probably put, you know, the Iridium satellite in and it would pop up.